da 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 da.
You sound insane. You realize that?
Yeah.
The whole world gone crazy.
Are you serious?
It's showtime.
Another week here on the Mad About Movies podcast, and another overly ambitious science fiction film for us to attempt to explain. Yeah, it's like clockwork these days, and we're just trying to keep up the best we can. Welcome again to another week, like I said, of Mad About Movies. I'm Kent, your trusty host, as always, most of the time, but joining me all the time is Brian and Richard. Hey, guys.
Hello, sir.
Hey.
Good day to you both.
How are you guys doing?
Just chugging along,
just,
man.
You're still recovering from 50 Shades Freed, Richard.
Yeah,
the fact that it's going to be over, that's what I meant by recovering.
Well,
the fact that
and no watching more. It, I think, I'm trying to remember what it is. What's the theater where it kind of like blows air on you and stuff from the seat?
I've never, not allowed 40 in those theaters. My parents never let me in those.
4D kind of.
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about, but. The what is it? Smell-o-vision for 50 Shades? Yeah. They offer that. What is it? D-Box? Have you ever seen the
Dakota does not smell great.
She doesn't.
Her teeth look like her breath.
That's why she was showering in the Social Network. It's just like it wasn't part of the scene, but there's like Dakota just, all right, your character's going to be showering. Justin Timberlake's going to be here asking you about Facebook. All right. have you ever heard of those D-Box things? Have you guys tried those out in the theater? You know what I'm referring to?
I do know what you're referring to, but I don't know.
I've never been to a theater with them?
No.
Anything like that?
I don't think so.
The theater that I go to while I'm at training camp during the summer, which is every August, if you listen to the show, you know I'm on remote pretty much for 3 or 4 episodes in a row during the summer. And so the theater I go to during that time, they do have the D-Box. And I remember during camp having to go see, by myself, mind you, it was a great time, going to see on opening weekend, The Dark Tower. Oh, remember that experience.
What a great film.
But I recall a few moviegoers or patrons, I like to call them patrons because it's a tradition unlike any other. And I saw these people and they had to have paid over $20 to sit in the D-Box experience for The Dark Tower. I'm sure that was exhilarating. Sure, it added to the thrilling experience that it already was, but
jeez.
I sat in the row kind of behind the D-Box, and so what D-Box is, it's essentially like a seat that moves during the movie, like the Six Flags ride. Remember they had that, like the right stuff at Six Flags where you'd sit in there
and
make you feel like you're in a jet? It's essentially that, but they do it for the movie. I don't know what they do during dialogue scenes. Do they just kind of like wobble or vibrate during the scene? I don't understand the appeal.
You can feel the dialogue
to be jolted around in your seat during Thanos's final attack in Infinity War. I'd rather be sitting still, but that's the appeal. But no, I was just reminded of
sounds
that
awesome
for 50 sounds Shades awesome. Freed. So if you did the 50 Shades Freed D-Box experience, please leave us a safe for work email at madaboutmoviespodcast@gmail.com.
Jeez. Imagine.
Lots to get to tonight. We have a guest joining us to talk Annihilation.
Yeah.
Yes, exciting times. We got weekly recommends. We got some reboot/sequel news to talk. But before we do that, I think an elephant in the room is that Black Panther is totally dominating still at the box office, and it's the topic of conversation still in the movie business and amongst the fans and everything like that. We realize that, but we did a very long episode last week covering Black Panther, and I felt like we got it all out for the most part, but we will talk about that movie again here in the next few weeks when Avengers Talk ramps up again. But $111 million last week domestically for Black Panther.
It's a record, isn't it?
I think it's
second week record.
There's I think there's only been three other movies have $100 million the second weekend. I don't think it was, I think it was the,
like
the
Mike,
most.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like Mike. Yeah. Richie Rich starring Macaulay Culkin. Really odd. But
watched
it was,
that the other day. I watched Richie Rich the other day. Pretty
weird. Weird.
It's the
pretty
best banging. John Larroquette film.
Well, I love Richie when I was a kid. So I'm in. I'm all in.
How does it hold up?
It is exactly as good as it was in 1993 or whatever.
Better it's, or worse than Spy's World in 2018?
Better. Much significantly better. Yeah. Significantly.
I love 90s movies tropes, man. Just, all right, you're the kid who likes food. All right, you're the urban kid. All right, you're the tomboy
Bruce,
girl.
Bruce, yeah. Bruce.
God. You've got your own Bruce. McDonald's? We need to do throwback to Richie Rich one of these days. Man, I've probably seen that 98 times in my life. Good times. But
I'm there.
Another 100 million racking up the total so far for Black Panther in week two, mind you, to $403 million. And that's not too
it's
bad.
Impressive.
For
it's a lot of money.
For old Marvel. Good to see something good go for Marvel's way again.
They really, really deserve a break there.
Really, yeah. Really need the money. Second place, last weekend, Game Night debuting with $17 million. I think we're going to do this in the next couple of weeks. We'll get to it. Getting good reviews, comedies are always in our wheelhouse, and so that conversation will be happening. And,
I'm excited. I'm excited to see that one. I like everyone involved with that movie, so I'm glad to see that it's doing well.
You
doing
too.
Well.
I do too. And that's not a bad debut. Probably solid. If Black Panther wasn't out, it probably would have done 2025 opening weekend if it had been a normal weekend. So third place, Brian, I'm going to ask you, have you seen it with Coop Peter Rabbit? Has he make
No. God, no. No. I'm trying to stay away. Anything with James Corden, I'm trying to stay away from. That's my new bit. I'm just going
to
start hating. Nobody owns
well,
that corner. So I'm
yes,
getting in
they
on
do,
it.
Man. There's a whole Vice section about anti James Corden stuff. Seriously.
All right. Well, I'm team anti James Corden. Then.
You have to avoid literally all of culture, though. Unfortunately,
yeah.
If you avoid it,
that's fine.
It,
so. That's okay.
Coop loved
good.
The.
I've had enough culture.
Coop loved the Little Yachty carpool karaoke, though. I mean, that was your son, your 4-year-old, just really into.
No, I just took Coop with me to see Annihilation. He's a big fan of like hard science fiction. Really, more than anything, it's just anything Natalie Portman is in, he's in on. Especially
right. Loves
digital
Black
shorts. Thorn. Yeah, digital shorts especially. He's really in on those.
Portman.
So how did he like 50 Shades? Or
no? Say something real nice about Jar Jar Binks. Kent, have you seen the new one, the new Natalie rap that they brought
back?
Yeah,
yes, I have, yes. Yeah,
it was great. The Jar Jar part is worth the whole
funniest thing they've done in 5 years.
It's because Lindley Allen wrote it.
And once again, let's rehash things from the past. That's SNL's signature these days. They can't have it's physically impossible for them to have it an episode of SNL without a celebrity cameo / former SNL cast member, aside from the host, mind you, showing up. They can't. It's impossible for it to happen. But that's another conversation that we've had way too many times on the show. So that brings me to Annihilation, fourth place, $11 million. The debut, it seems to be on par with what they were projecting, but not to say that it's breaking any records by any means. And wow, still in the top six, Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle. Still
the movie of
money.
2017. Crazy. Yes. It's crazy.
Domestically, it's made $387 million, which is still less than Black Panther.
It's
how mind blowing Black Panther is, and how much money it's going to make at the end of the day domestically. So wow, still happening out there before the Oscars. Usually, there's not a lot of conversation between the announcement of the awards and the awards which are taking place this weekend and all that. But I think studios are starting to change their tune a little bit with maybe especially with the success of Get Out last year. You know, maybe they're looking at this window of this February March window of we can really do some business here and launch some franchises and take advantage of this kind of doldrum of no movies coming out. That seems to be different from the norm of the past couple of years. You guys have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it seems like this the release calendar for 2018 is weird because it's just like even today there was another Robin Hood's going to move from September to Thanksgiving, and I believe Robin Hood had already moved at least once this year. Like it's kind of like chess pieces going all over the board. But it does seem like we're starting to see the
everything I do.
That's what I'm hoping for this year. I really hope Taron Egerton sings it this time.
No, it's Sam Smith. They're redoing it with Sam.
Oh, well.
They would, though, right? Yeah. If they thought of that.
I'm less interested in that. Yeah, it seems like maybe, to your point, Kent, that like the studios are starting to say it's better, turns out, to have a wide window in which to dominate than it is to be like the sixth place movie immediately. It's weird. I know it's strange that it took us, you know, like 100 years to figure that out, but it's a better idea to get 5 or 6 weeks of solid take than just like, well, we had one good weekend and then Black Panther came along and swallowed everything, just destroyed everybody else. And then we were gone. It's spread it out, guys. Find ways to find pockets in the release calendar where you can kind of sit and own a couple weeks and you're probably going to be better off. So maybe that's starting to happen. And maybe if we're lucky in 5 years, then even like January and all of September will be decent for just like not even great movies, but just I want to go to the theater, you know. That'd be great. That'd be fantastic.
Yeah, and I think it's the age-old saying of if it's good, people will go see it. And I think they're realizing, hey, we can put out a couple of good movies during this time and get some good attention rather than saving the good movies for a 3 week period in the fall or in the summer. So spread the wealth around a little bit. It seems to be working so far. Okay. So a few movie news items to hit. Speaking of reboots / sequels that I teased earlier, Chris Tucker confirming Rush Hour 4, guys.
Oh, no.
Thoughts, Richard? I know you got hot takes on Rush Hour 4.
Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth?
I do. I do, but I'm not interested. After that line it gets uttered, what is it bringing to the table?
Do it again, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah.
Who directs that?
I didn't know there was a Rush Hour 3. Oh, Ratner will from over... like a
from Thailand
prison
or something.
Skype thing, yeah. Okay. Like that dude, that bro that did Girls Gone Wild, that like lives in, he's on the lamb.
No, it'll
know,
be like a it'll be a Mick America. G affair. It'll be Mick G will bring back the Rush Hour.
Gosh,
with associate executive producer Guy Fieri bringing it back.
How dare you? Don't besmirch his name.
No, that's a compliment. Executive producer.
Yeah.
Is that inevitable, do people want that? I just don't feel like Chris Tucker, Jackie Chan has really stayed super relevant up to this point. I don't hear a lot, and it's like they're on the Netflix rotation, and people are remembering how great Rush Hour was. I guess it's something that they could make, so that's why they're doing it.
There you go. You hit the nail on the head there. Yeah, we can do this. Well, I guess we should then. That kind of seems to be the mode of operandus there.
Well, hey, man. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, if you think about, it's nuts that Jackie Chan. I mean, obviously he's older and than he was, but I mean, China is so much more than. It's the most important market now in film and in everything, really. And so, cynically, I think doing this is probably a very good idea because it's a huge property over there. And now there's even more people and more of an emphasis on art and culture that there wasn't 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. Yeah.
And so I think it's probably a smart thing to do. It would be smarter to have a younger, like reboot it with with Kevin Hart, but there's no, at least to America, I can't think of a young Jackie Chan. I'm sure there's stars in China that would be big, but mm-hmm. I think, you know, you kind of hedge and say, okay, we'll bring back Jackie for this. And who is a huge global star. So this will make a ton of money in the new China and the new cinema landscape, but it's
true. Meh.
Seems to be a little bit of seems to be a little bit of nostalgia for Jackie Chan. Past couple years, he was awarded the Lifetime Achievement Oscar, I think, a couple last year. And he also was in a very mildly successful movie called The Foreigner last year, which is kind of gave him a little reboot in the action world. It was a John Wick kind of equalizer.
I watched
that.
I saw that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was strange. It was it was not what I expected it to be at all. I thought it was going to be what you said. I thought it was going to be like Taken or John Wick or something like that. Right. And it's, did you see it, Kent?
I've not seen it yet. No.
It's about the IRA pretty much. It's Pierce Brosnan's movie and Jackie Chan just sort of appears here and there. It's I was very confused. I did not expect that from, you know, the marketing campaign that pushed Jackie Chan. He's in about 20 minutes of the movie. It's very strange. I don't understand, but you know, I saw it. I probably wouldn't have seen it if you just told me it's an IRA movie starring Pierce Brosnan. So I guess there's that. They got my $3 at Family Video. So, you know, what are you gonna do?
That's funny. I did watch, oddly enough, I watched Jackie Chan's First Strike probably 2 weeks ago. I hadn't seen it since I was maybe 9 or so. And fond memories, man, flashback to that. It's like the ski sequences and that, man, just some fun, weird moments in my mind that it was recalling. But Jackie Chan's First Strike, side recommend for that one. Jackie Chan's good stuff. And there's some good nostalgic stuff with Jackie Chan. But that's the thing. It's all nostalgia with Chris Tucker. I mean, I tried to watch Chris Tucker. He did a Netflix special, I think, last year, stand-up, and it was not funny. I really wanted to say, man, this guy's back. I love Chris Tucker because I do like the guy, really likable guy. I don't know if he has it anymore. He just loves sitting courtside at Sacramento Kings games and things like that. Like, good for him, you know, do that life and keep being Chris Tucker. But I'm not very interested in this at all, and don't think I've revisited Rush Hour since its original run, and have had no desire to. So if this goes well,
the last time I saw him was on the bus with Coach Starks, Kent, in like New York.
Chris Tucker,
eighth grade trip. No, the last time I saw Rush Hour.
Oh, Rush Hour. Oh, I thought he's like just saw.
I have a very
Chris
vivid
Tucker,
memory
like, through the window or something.
20 years ago, coming up on
So if this does well, you know they're gonna call Owen Wilson and be like, "Hey, Shanghai Knights 2 or 3 or whatever it is." Just bring back all the Jackie and all the early 90s franchises that we can. That's all. That's what we want in our life, right? Speaking of...
That's what we all need.
That's what we all need. Paramount, speaking of China, has dropped from its release calendar Transformers 6. Pour one out, guys.
Get out of here.
Yeah. Yep. They're going forward with Bumblebee, which is filming now or just wrapped production with Haley Steinfeld, John Cena, and Bumblebee. So it's a spinoff of Transformers some way by a different director. I think Michael Bay is involved in a production stamp or, I mean, a producer's role. But yeah, not at the helm in the director's chair. And the Transformers series, as we know it, is all but dead other than this spinoff. And if that doesn't work, then they might be done for a while, a good while, until, of course, they reboot it someday, which they will. But, man.
Probably with Michael Bay directing again. He just keeps coming back.
Yeah, it's all because I bet on it in the movie draft, that it ended Transformers for good. Took one for the team, guys. No more Despicable Me, no more Transformers. You're welcome.
We still need that Grown Ups 2 episode.
Yeah. Oh, it's happening. Oh, ew, it's happening. I'm excited. Guess pour one out, but no, because it's the most offensive movie in the history of cinema that I said the last night was the worst movie in the history of filmmaking. So let's end on a good note, guys. Good job. Good run. We did it. We completely destroyed movie making as we know it.
Drunk Merlin. Come on. You didn't love Drunk Merlin. Who doesn't love Drunk Merlin?
I love the Galileo.
It's my fantasy football team name. So
strong. At least you're going out on top. Way to go, Transformers.
Exactly.
You took a very middling movie and turned it into like maybe the worst franchise of all time. Congratulations.
Hey, but it should be said, not to bring this up again, they did make like $10 billion along the way. So yeah. I get it, Paramount.
Yeah. Michael Bay has like 18 monster machines in his house. Just every day he just can crush monster energy drinks left and right.
It's disappointing because
sick.
I mean, in a way it is disappointing because I mean that first Transformers movie, it showed
it's fine.
Promise, yeah. Potential. It's like, wow, this could be really fun. There's some fun moments, characters. It works on the big screen. It's got this big scale to it. It just went down the entirely wrong path, and they drove themselves into the ground.
Yeah.
I think they could be making $1 billion each movie and do it forever if these movies were good. It's just they're just bad,
decent.
And they're just decent.
Yeah.
Everyone is worse than the one before it, and they're just driving it. They drove it into the ground. That's what they did. They could have just made a B movie every single time, grades wise, a B movie, and everyone would have been fine, and no one would have complained and been like, yeah, they make, you know, just like Fast and Furious. Yeah, they make a ton of money, but they're all decent and people have fun and no one really cares. And it's just kind of fun, you know, instead of people viscerally hating it. Hasbro can't be very excited about the way things turned out with that. Thanks Michael Bay for that, driving into the ground, but man, pour one out.
It's not great, but it's over. Our long nightmare is over for the foreseeable future anyway. So that's good.
Yeah.
I got one piece of news, Kento. We did not talk about this. Broke after we recorded last week, I believe. So, Joss Whedon out on Batgirl, and DC / Warner Brothers remains in incredible flux once again.
Okay, inform me on this. It could go one of two ways. One, Joss saying, "Man, I got other opportunities. You know, other things I want to do." Or the other way of, I got to get out of this thing right now because this ship is sinking fast.
His official release or statement or whatever just said, I'm going to paraphrase because
it's been an honor to work with the great people at DC. I've learned so much and I wish them the best. Joss Whedon.
What he said was, I started writing this and I've worked on it and I realized I don't have a story, and if I don't have a story, I don't feel like I should be the one to direct it, and so I'm going to step away. And you know, which is number one, good for him. If you don't have something written, then good for you for just saying, "You know what? I'm out on this." But I have a hard time, maybe I'm very cynical on it, but I just have a hard time believing that there's not a great deal more to it just based on this place is a terrible, this is just the worst place to work right now. And it's a terrible, clearly the structure of the company is just, it's just in shambles. It's not working. And I'm going to get out of this before I have, multiple Warner Brothers DC movies on my resume that may hinder me from doing other things. So he's gone and I have no clue. Yeah. I mean, Twitter was kind of like fielding people to write a Batgirl movie, and rightly so, was looking for talented female writers and directors to helm that project, and that's great. But I would love for all of them to stay away, just because I just don't believe that it can be. I don't know. Wonder Woman is like that one beacon of hope within the entire universe, and that's Patty Jenkins and Gal Gadot, and so maybe that's the road we go down. We try to get like Catherine Bigelow or something. I don't know, but it's I would tell everybody, stay away. Warner Brothers needs to shut down. They need to shut down the DC extended universe for like 5 to 10 years and come back and try again later. Like, let's just get some time away. And I know they got the Matt Reeves Batman movie, but even that, like, do we you know, is there any chance that Affleck is going to be Batman? I don't know. They keep dragging this out too. I have no faith that anything is getting done properly there.
Richard?
Yeah, no, it seems more and more to be such a WB issue, you know, and a management issue and a lack of infrastructure to control the properties rather than really a filmmaking issue. You can't just throw money at these. It doesn't work. And it may work early, you know, when the excitement's bigger. And that was their issue, is they didn't listen when these first came out. They made a lot of money. And so they just said, yeah, well, we're just going to stick this in our ears and not listen to these reviews because these people are stupid. And that works for a few movies, but there's diminishing returns after a while. And people that go and see them and they're like, that was really bad, or that was just aggressive, or whatever people thought. And then they stop going after a while because they never adjusted, save for Wonder Woman, where they, you know, kind of went a different route. So, yeah, I mean, I think I'm with Brian. I think it just needs to go away. And,
they got to reset. They got to
write a LeBron letter.
Yeah.
And, you know, and say, hey, we screwed up and we're back in Cleveland now. And we've hired someone awesome to run this. And we're going to start from scratch. And we really appreciate everyone that's worked on this. And all the failures are on us and not on you. And check us out in 3.5 years when the first one of these hits, because we're going to take our time and make it right. You know, that to me, that would be the only way to do it.
Who's somebody that they could put in charge of this new, say they do blow everything up, right? Say they go on with Wonder Woman 2, but that's it. That's the only film that they go forward with from here on out, even though they're doing Aquaman. We know that. But say they decide, okay, after the ones we've committed to, we're done. Who could they bring in and say, this is our guy, this is our Kevin Feige, this is our Kathleen Kennedy, right? That's going to sail the ship. I mean, they sort of announced Christopher Nolan at the beginning of this,
and
he backed out after Man of Steel to do other things and to not be bogged down. Who could restore the fanboys' faith in this?
That's the problem, is like, I can't think of any names, because what they keep doing and what the names that I could come up with are the same that they could come up with. The problem, or that they have a tried to come up with. The problem is, you don't, I guess it was Justice League, our friend Batman Shane said, and this was a great point, was like, you don't want a director or a filmmaker in that role. You need a producer running that whole department. That's what Kevin Feige is. That's what Kathleen Kennedy is. And, you know, Chris, we started with Chris Nolan, then they shifted to Zack Snyder. And I can't remember if they ever actually announced Joss Whedon as like the voice or the director, basically, of what's going to happen for the next, you know, five films or whatever. But that, it definitely seemed like that's what they wanted him to do, right? Was to be the Kevin Feige for the DC Extended Universe. And I just don't think that works. You need somebody with the voice who comes at it from a producer's angle and can figure out how to. Part of it, honestly, is coming up with like the formula that works for these movies and putting that on screen. And I don't know that that's ever going to be Christopher Nolan or Joss Whedon or any, let alone that those guys or girls, if you wanted to do Bigelow or say, like, I think it would be a very easy idea to just say, hey, we're just going to let Patty Jenkins be in charge of this. I don't know that she would be good at that, because, again, you're coming at it from a filmmaker's standpoint instead of. What you really need is a strong, steady hand in the producer's role.
What's Obama up to? Right?
Yeah.
Is this something he'd be interested in? someone with some like bureaucratic authority. Right. Yeah.
It has to have to be somebody with some experience, though. You know, somebody that's like, okay, guys, here's what you're doing wrong, and here's how we can fix it. I just don't know.
Harvey Weinstein. I mean, is he?
I'm thinking of people like Amy Pascal.
Yeah, sure.
You know, the ex-executives that are still doing good work, producing movies, but aren't really tied down. The Frank Marshalls, you know, those people.
That's what you're looking for. Yeah. And honestly, the name is probably somebody that we've never heard of, or that mass audiences haven't heard of. Because I'd never heard of Kevin Feige before Iron Man.
Right.
And that's, I think, is the case for 99% of the people that saw Iron Man.
You didn't read his blogs?
Or maybe Zanga, sir.
I mean, maybe they're so contracted up, but there's got to be some deputy of his.
Right. That's what you should do.
You know, you go with the move like the, well, we don't know who to hire. Who's the lead assistant on the Spurs? We'll just hire them.
Yes, exactly.
You know, like that happens in sports all the time.
That's what they tried to do with Joss.
It's a director.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you got to find someone who's like
Matt Patricia, you know?
Yeah. Whoever Kevin Feige's right hand man is, that's probably who you should be talking. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Because at least he knows like at what, it's stupid stuff, but it's like at what phases do we have meetings during production?
When do we need to see a final draft of the script?
Right.
What, you know, what you know, just like basic, like,
when do we all take creatine shots? Well, yeah, it's at 10 and 3.
But it's like, it's an operational gig. It's a managerial gig. And just basically mimic, you don't have to mimic the creative, but I think Marvel has shown, and I'm not a Marvel fan, but I, like I always say, I have no dog in this fight. I didn't read comic books as a kid. I read Animorphs. Ken Griffey Jr. biography's like a man, but anyway, you know, you can do your own thing on the creative, but if you could mimic the operational, I think that I noticed with Marvel is it's not really the 99s, the Black Panthers of the world. And I'm saying Rotten Tomato scores, but just like overall consensus of loved, it's the amount of films they have that they only have one that's like kind of hated. And that's where operations is key.
The batting average is very high,
You can have all the creative you want, but operational managerial control, what that does is it raises the basement. And your ceiling's totally going to be done by your creative. But if you have good management, it makes it like the worst movie we're going to make is going to be like a 58 on Rotten Tomatoes and be kind of mixed review. That's the bottom we can do because we know how to run these meetings, and that's why it's worth going and getting someone from Marvel. That's the impressive thing about Marvel.
That's why it works for...
And that's how you build a brand in a universe is with that way, that consistency.
So that's why it works for Pixar, you know? So it works in the corporate world for companies like Apple that can turn over their entire staff and still put out a consistent product. You're right. Yeah. It is it's more of a culture problem there than it is a talent problem. I think everybody knows that. And the people that are involved in the culture that got themselves into it, the Ben Afflecks of the world, the Joss Whedons, are like, got to get out of this. It's not for me. It's toxic. And man, they got to stop, and they've got to bring somebody in here who has some kind of original outlook on it. Maybe. And I wanted to ask Batman Shane this. Can they do Batgirl without an established Batman movie already out there? You know, this is what our Batman is now. Now here's Batgirl. Or do you start with Batgirl? Because doesn't Batgirl essentially look up to Batman and copy him? Or, you know, wasn't it Alfred's niece or whatever? Doesn't Batman have to exist? Doesn't Batman have to exist for Batgirl to exist? I guess is my question to Batman. Yeah. The canon of the whole thing. How would that work? So, man, always fun times at good old WB in DC.
WB.
Right here, throwing our name in the ring. Us three. We'll ride this ship if you're listening. We got this. Yeah.
Richard just doesn't want to help. No, I'm good.
I'm super handsy in the office, too, with everyone.
That's
male,
true.
Female, anything. Yeah. Old, young. Yeah. I'm handsy, so you don't want me.
It's a very timely comment, too.
No, I'm just saying, like, I don't want the job. Purposely trying to get fired before I can get it.
You could walk in and say four things and still do a better job than what they're doing now. Four random sentences, I will, and still probably give better advice than what.
Are we sure? How committed to the piss jar are we?
Sentences like that. Thing that could change.
I've got an entire trilogy of ideas for the piss jar.
All right, let's hear them. I'll be in my office.
Are we sure General Zod has to turn into a dinosaur? That's the 100% on that. Okay, just making sure. Just asking. Throwing that out there. Wow,
it would be great to have me just walking around the office, kind of eating, you know. Just snacking on stuff, asking really obvious common sense questions. And I'm very confused by everything. And then I'm like, ooh, all my notes are like, no woods. There was way too many trees.
What makes me laugh so much about the Beavis thing and the piss jar is the screenplay was probably like, camera. Pans down
interior
on,
done.
And then it pans down on all caps jar of piss. So the prop guy is like looking at all the stuff I got to make for the scene. He's like, all right, jar of piss. And I can just picture him in the back, like mixing different colors to get the perfect color of pee.
It can't actually be urine, I'm sure, because it's definitely.
No, yeah, the
we've
guy
established
definitely
this before. It's definitely just, Zack did, Snyder's piss. Yeah. There's no question. Yeah.
No, Zack Snyder's piss is too way too thick.
Like, yeah, I know. It it's like, can see like protein poo. Particles. Yeah.
It looks like floating in sludge or slime or whatever from Ninja Turtles.
The ooze.
Yeah, the ooze.
It's glowing. It's like radioactive. You need to see a doctor. He's like, I'm cool. Have you seen my biceps? I think I'm fine. Okay. All right. That about does it for movie news, rumors, rumblings, banter.
Piss jar. Yeah.
Let's welcome in our guest and talk Annihilation.
We've sent in drones and teams of people, but nothing comes back.
But something has.
You're a biologist. You served in the military.
If I knew what happened, I could save his life.
The boundary's getting bigger. It's expanding. We're talking cities, states.
You need to know what's inside. So do I.
It's beautiful.
All right, welcome back to the show here today. We are joined by our guest, one of our wonderful, beautiful VIP members.
They're all beautiful.
All of them. I text
them all pics, and they all send them pics back, and they're all beautiful. And
every single person, it's like you join and you get one.
You just immediately, you're wondering why Patreon asked for your phone number. It's for me. Yeah. That's actually not standard. I had them put that in, so then I just get. You get a welcome message.
I will say this: your texts are less sexual in nature than I expected,
but still.
But I mean,
heavily sexual. Yeah, no, yeah,
yeah. It's still quite explicit. But explicit. Better than
weird
better
side.
What Kent and I get at least. So
yeah, just like what up? you listen to ma'am right now? Cool.
Cool.
Yeah, I remember that app. No, welcome back, man. Welcome back to the show.
Kyle, what's up, man?
Not too much. Just enjoying some annihilation, you know?
Nice, nice. So Kyle's been with us before.
He's been annihilated by his last appearance, which was Power Rangers. Yeah.
Hey, yo. Still recovering. Power Rangers, man. So you were with us around this time last year for Power Rangers, and then you're here now for Annihilation. I hope one of those movies is better than the other. So we'll see what your thoughts are on that. I'm sure we got your answers to these questions last time around, but you know, we gain listeners every day. We go from 12 listeners to like 14 listeners at least once a month. So we may have new people that have just tuned in. So our guest is Kyle. Kyle, I'm going to ask you two very important questions, and then we're going to get started on Annihilation Talk. Have you seen Now You See Me?
I have seen Now You See Me 1, 2, and already pre-bought the tickets for 3.
Wow, look at that. That's a true fan. That's a true fan right there. Okay, do you have any thoughts you want to share on those illustrious fine films, or do you want me to head on into the next question?
All I have to say is that it's probably Mark Ruffalo's 16th and 17th best performances as an actor. I've done the research, and it checks out.
All right. I like that. That's good. I'm a big fan of lists, as everyone knows. Okay. Have you seen, this is question number 2. Have you seen our favorite movie around here? Have you seen MacGruber?
Well, how else are you supposed to learn how to do the old celery trick?
There we go. This is a veteran right here, ladies and gentlemen.
Absolutely. He was probably going thick end first for a long time.
It's counterintuitive though. You don't want to go thin end.
Exactly.
It's going to slide right out. You don't want that.
Never, ever say never, ever. All right, good. Well, Kyle, you are our guest, as you know, and everyone else knows at this point. So we want to let you start off. Give me, if you have any background with this film or Alex Garland or, you know, whatever, and maybe what made you choose Annihilation as your film of choice to join us for, and then just kind of give us your general thoughts, and then we'll move on into the big stuff later.
Sure thing. So I mainly chose this movie because of Alex Garland, big Alex Garland fan. I don't know what the fan club is called, but I would consider myself a member.
Garlandites.
Okay. I'm slightly an amateur still. He hasn't done a whole lot. This is his second directorial movie. Really liked Ex Machina before this. And then the movies he wrote.
That's Latin for the Machina.
Really?
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that. Yeah,
I'm gonna have to take that down in my notes. But I also like the movies he wrote before it, like Sunshine, Never Let Me Go, Dread. So I've been all over his career and wanting to see what he was going to do next. I have not read the book, so I had no background with what the plot was going to be loosely, but kind of distrusted what he was doing, and then saw the cast come out and saw it was a pretty dynamite cast that they had put together. So I was really intrigued at what he was going to do with it. It was still in that kind of wheelhouse of sci-fi that he operates in. So I had fairly high expectations going in. General thoughts wise, I thought this was an interesting role for Natalie Portman, because you really don't get to see her do anything that's like this, where she kind of gets to do her own thing, get to be a former military person, get to kind of have that action-y role. The only thing that I can really think of that was comparable was maybe V for Vendetta was kind of close, but it really wasn't even that close when I was thinking about it. So I thought she was really good in that role. The first thing I think you notice when you watch this movie is how beautiful it is. It's a beautiful visual movie when you see it, and it kind of takes you over and you get lost in the visuals sometimes. And I had a couple of moments where I had to refocus and say, okay, where am I at here? What's going on? Because some of the things were pretty overwhelming. But long story short, I loved it. I thought it hit me emotionally, kind of like a Blade Runner 2049 or Arrival have kind of recently in that sci-fi genre. And it hit every expectation I had and more.
Sweet. Kent, what about you?
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm big Alex Garland guy, Ex Machina, Machina, whatever you want to, however we want to say it. It's
Latin for the Machina.
The Machina.
It's pronounced Machina, but it's Latin.
Yeah, the Machine. Was my number one of that year. I was very high on that. Love the performances, love the atmosphere, love the script, loved almost everything about that, and the ending especially. So I had high expectations for this. Didn't know much about the property. The trailer does a very good job of, A, keeping it ambiguous, but bad job of letting us know what this movie's about, or pitching it to anyone who doesn't know what Annihilation is, or follow Alex Garland's career very closely. So, yeah, doesn't have that going for it for the general population, but this movie definitely aims for that highbrow internet fanboy, go online and talk about theories of the ending crowd. And I think this movie has all of the elements that you want. And that I heard a lot of glowing reviews about this, that this movie was terrifying, that it blended horror and science fiction perfectly, that it was more intellectual than you would anticipate it being. And I think we had probably indications that this wasn't going to be a great film, considering the buzz and everything and the projection, but ended up being better well-received critically than we had anticipated. But all that to say, this was a lot slower burn than I expected it to be or wanted it to be. Once it starts going, you know, the last, I would say, 20, 25 minutes, I was mesmerized. Loved the last 20, 25 minutes. The setup was way too drawn out, I thought. There were some issues with the pacing. It wasn't as scary as people had said. There was one sequence in particular that was pretty scary, but other than that, I felt like they could have done a lot more with the scary unknown of the Shimmer itself. And but overall, I think this movie is working towards the ending and leading up to that. And that's what the conversation today is going to be mainly about, I'm sure. And so for that, in terms of a conversation starter, I think this is a good science fiction film. It's not the strongest that I've seen. I liked Arrival more. I liked Ex Machina more. But this definitely has a lot of questions still to be explained at the end of the day. So for that reason, I'm a fan, but I'm not a fan for other reasons. So a little bit conflicted, but still have a positive experience, I would say, overall of the screening. So, Brian, what about you?
Yeah, so I read this book maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and I felt like it was I was very excited when they announced that this was going to be made into a movie and that Alex Garland was going to take over, because I felt like the book is very dense and good. Like I don't know how to put that. I enjoyed the experience of reading it. It was a really interesting story, but there's two sequels and I haven't read them, and I'm a pretty avid reader. And so I feel like that says a bit. It was a lot to kind of get through. And I'm not a particularly visual reader. I have trouble kind of visualizing the settings and the landscapes and whatnot that authors describe. I'm not particularly great at that, and there's a lot of that in this book. So I was really excited to have it brought to the screen. The movie has, just if you're wondering, the movie has very little to do with the book. It's kind of title and just like the two-page treatment version, basically. It's a lot different. And I didn't remember just a whole lot about it. I had to go back today and read after I came out of the movie and search for differences between book and movie just to remind myself. And it's widely different, but I think it goes hand in hand with it. And so I give Alex Garland a lot of credit for that. And to be fair, Jeff Vanderveer, the author, has said the same thing. Just like, I think he did a really good job of figuring out what to take from the book and then just kind of making his own movie. But it is reminiscent almost of like World War Z a few years ago, where that movie to book is basically like the title and that's about it. And everything else is completely different. So just in case you're wondering about that, listeners and or other hosts, but the movie itself, I didn't love Ex Machina. I thought Ex Machina was a very, very good movie that left me personally a little cold and unsettled. And, like, it was the best episode of Black Mirror ever.
yep.
And which is great. Like, there's nothing wrong with that whatsoever, but it for me personally, that's not my, I don't know, cup of tea or my personal favorite kind of film. And so it just kind of left
me. You're an Earl Grey guy.
Yeah, obviously, and chamomile. So I think this movie, if we're just comparing to Ex Machina, I think Ex Machina is definitely a better movie. I enjoyed this movie much more. I thought Garland did a great job of unfolding the plot and the experience of being in the Shimmer and in Area X, and kind of gave, and then just let his actresses kind of do some of the heavy lifting. I don't know. I feel like this is a movie, and I expected it from the trailer, and clearly the studio expected this too. We saw all kinds of stuff about how they're not releasing it in England, right? I think we saw that. Yeah, like, they're not
internationally released. It's going to Netflix, apparently. Yeah.
Okay. That's what it was. Yes.
Yeah.
And here the trailer was really bad and the advertising campaigns are very confusing. It's a dense book that turned into a movie that I don't think is particularly dense. Like, I'm looking at some of the reviews on Rotten Tomatoes right now and just seeing some of the negatives are people who are kind of confused by it. And I didn't feel like it was, I felt like that was one of the things that made it work, was that Alex Garland kind of made it relatively simple. It's a hard sci-fi movie, but it's not, I don't think it was overly complex or convoluted for me. And that either means maybe the book helped me, or perhaps I'm dumb and I just was, okay, I'll go with it, which I am apt to do. So maybe that's about me as much as anything. But to your point, Kyle, dude, I thought it looked incredible. It's one of the better looking films we've seen over the last few years. Garland has an incredible eye for the camera. I enjoyed all the cast and stuff. Kent, you're right. There's some pacing stuff here and there. But I kind of liked that it was 2 hours and we're done. And we didn't have to spend another 30 minutes kind of fleshing out what happens to these characters and whatnot. So I thought it was pretty cut and dry, and it worked really well for me. So I enjoyed it a lot. It's going to be, I mean, obviously it's very high on my list for this year because I've seen like four movies, but this, I imagine come October, I'm still going to be pretty high on this as compared to a lot of the other movies we've seen. So that's where I'm at. Richard, what are your general thoughts and how do you feel about this this experience so far?
Yeah, it's a weird one. I mean, there's so much to like about this movie. First off, like you all have touched on, the cinematography and just the overall aesthetic feel of it's really wonderful, I thought, especially in the Shimmer, and it's kind of a really unique and magical thing. And there's parts of this movie that are terrifying. We'll get into the bear here in a little bit. Dream bear or whatever, night bear, I'm calling him.
Ayo.
Yahtzee. Yeah, so that was spooky, and there's some really kind of fun jump scenes in it. I just, the only, and I liked it. I mean, I'm going to give it a good grade. I just don't want to total. It did leave me a little bit cold, kind of like you did with Ex Machina, Brian. It just, I guess it might have been just the kind of unsettlingness of, that's not a word, but the unsettling nature of the ending, I think, kind of just left me walking out of it like in a worse mood than I was probably an hour in when I was really enjoying it. I hate when that happens. You know, it's like I dug that, but now I'm like, now I'm walking out on sort of a sour note, and I blame that on the book. I was like, oh, that's probably just, you know, Garland did everything he could, but the book just has that. But now that I've listened to you, Brian, for the first time ever, I learned that that's maybe not the case, and maybe this is narratively a little bit more on Garland. But it's one of those movies to me that's like really good, and until it's not, not that it's bad, but it's like it's a little bit of a dip in the third act for me, whether it's pacing or not, but there's everything's great in it. I mean, like I said, the look and feel, the actors are great. There's not too many cringe moments in it. It's smart enough, especially for kind of a genre. It reminded me had a lot of Alien in it. The parts that are good have a lot of Alien in it to me. Mm-hmm. That kind of the tone of it and the level of kind of unpredictability and actual stakes and scariness was very Alien to me, and I like that, because that's just not a movie that, those kind of movies don't happen a lot. I enjoyed it on the whole, but I don't think this will make my top 10 of the year. These are always I hate doing these movies, like it's nothing really to gripe about except for a few nuanced things, hard to just lavish praise on too. So it's like these are the episodes I hate doing the most. But anyway, we'll throw it back to you guys, because I'm sort of stammering around like an idiot more than even normal.
It seemed to me that you guys are definitely complimentary more of the first half of the film and less of the second half. I'm less high on the first half and way more high on the second half. To me, once the expedition is explained, right? Once the Shimmer is sort of explained, and Natalie Portman, her character is in the Shimmer, and we're in the Shimmer, right? I expected it, or anticipated it, to be more of a, like you said, a unknown adventure story, like similar to Predator or something like that, where they're in this crazy terrain, and they don't know, they have, you know, I thought the trope in the movie of no communication with the outside world, how it scrambles all their signals or whatever, I thought they were going to really use that to, like, they were going to be in severe danger and have to get in contact but not be able to, and all these different scenarios, right? I expected it to be more of a physical adventure style movie, like a Jaws or something, where they're making their way through this land, you know, ultimately to the lighthouse at the end, a very simple kind of journey. But it ended up being more of a philosophical exploration, a journey. It ended up being more of a melancholia type experience than a Predator type experience, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Is that what you expected? I really liked the explanation. I think you said it earlier, Brian, is that they really kind of lay it out for you. I didn't feel like this was very confusing at all in its exposition. You know, the first scene of the movie, the opening is that kind of asteroid hitting the Earth and forming this canopy area. So that's real. Okay, I believe it. An asteroid hit the Earth. Great. That's all I need to know. Then once they get in there, like, why is everything so weird? And then they explain that with, oh, the DNA is refracting. It's causing everything in this area to basically blend with each other. You know, humans, animals, whatever is in this area is one, essentially. Okay, great. Mm-hmm. I buy that. That's all you really need to know about this movie. And then the rest, I think you have some opportunity to have some fun here. And they have a scene with an alligator that is a little bit too short, in my opinion.
Alligator shark kind of thing?
Yeah, alligator shark thing, which it grabs somebody. It gets really good jump scare when it grabs a girl, but that's really it. And then the scene's essentially over. They're dissecting it or whatever. And then we get one more with, like, that polar bear with no face. And that's really it until the end. And that's more, again, philosophical in nature than physical. But so I guess you expect one thing and you get another. Not to say that that's a bad thing, but I felt like that setting of the Shimmer is such an opportunity for an alien world, right? An alien world within our own where you're discovering why things are the way they are. And it just felt a little too talky during that time, I guess, or we're spending a lot of time focusing on these girls' backstories or why they're in the Shimmer, or what motivated them to be there rather than having fun in this environment. Or I guess it's just a different film than I experienced. I expected more Jurassic Park, if that makes sense.
And sure.
During that time, like, we're in real danger and we got to find a way out. Didn't get much of that, but that's a small complaint. I ended up thinking a lot more than I expected to in this, but I guess that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I expected that going in because that's kind of how the book is. And even though plot-wise and development, there's very little similarity, that was more of the book, was like, what's the best? Almost like an Apocalypse Now kind of thing. Like they're going native in some ways. Like you're inside the Shimmer and you're going crazy, I guess, and trying to figure out not just like where you are, but like almost philosophically who you are and whatnot. So I guess I expected that. And I feel like that's probably what drew Alex Garland to the project as much as anything, is the idea the opportunity to explore that more so than just, he's only directed two movies, but I feel like that's pretty safe to say about him, is he's a little more interested in the psychology and the philosophy of it than he is necessarily just the sci-fi experience. Does that make sense?
That's actually surprising to hear you say that, because I see Alex Garland as an old school thriller science fiction writer, like a Alfred Hitchcock or an M. Night Shyamalan, somebody that just really throws back on just like, I'm going to do a sci-fi story and there's going to be a crazy twist and that's going to be my deal, you know?
I agree with that, but I think I would say the same thing about those people as well. Like, I think that Alfred Hitchcock was as much interested in psychologically messing with you and messing with his characters than he was in I agree with you. I think that he is an old school kind of throwback sci-fi thriller type director, which is what excites me about, and writer too for that matter. That's what excites me about his whatever future projects he has coming up, but that would be is that stuff. But I think that goes hand in, that element goes hand in hand with old school sci-fi slash thriller sort of films.
There are certain directors that you get the sense that when they think about a project, get pitched an idea, come up with an idea, that they're only thinking about the last 5 minutes, right? How do I build to this ending that I know is going to work if we do it right? Alex Garland is a perfect example of that, with Sunshine, with Ex Machina, with Dread, with Annihilation. I really think you can make or break a movie in the last 5 minutes. And he goes out on these limbs, man, on the end. This is another one. And we'll talk more about the end when we get to spoilers, because the ending that he wrote and the ending that's in the film are different. So there might have been a debate between him and the studio on what that should be, but that's something we could talk about here in a few seconds when we hit spoilers. But I want to give our guest a little bit more of a chance to give his thoughts on the movie. Kyle, what did you really enjoy about the movie besides the setting, Natalie Portman's performance, anything like that? Anything stick out to you on the positive end?
Well, something I always like in my sci-fi is that when the audience is on the same wavelength as the characters in terms of what they know, and we're kind of following them along the whole way. It never felt like there was any jumps in logic of, all right, now all of the women know this one thing and they now know all of the secrets to the Shimmer. I enjoyed that there was this aura of mystery the whole time, and it was pretty obvious to me, at least, that Alex Garland was not really interested in answering a lot of questions of the why, the how, or what's really going on here. It was, I'm going to let the audience kind of see what's going on here, let them interpret it a lot of different ways. And I'm sure the four of us are going to have a lot of different feelings about the ending and what it kind of meant to us and what we thought it was. So I think that's a sign of a really effective horror movie. And then kind of what you guys were saying too. I think the expectation was it was going to be more of a physical horror movie for people that weren't familiar with the property before, that it was going to be all these different creatures that they'd have to interact with. But I did enjoy that pivot towards the end that really turned it into something special for me, that it did become more of a introspective look at more human nature. And another thing that Garland likes to talk about is what it means to be human, kind of thing. So all of those kind of principles together was just a really enjoyable experience for me.
Yeah. What did you guys think about the scene setter of her in the facility being interviewed, interrogated about what happened? For some people, that can be seen as a negative because the stakes are... I don't want to go into spoilers now, but let's say the stakes are reduced by knowing that she ends up being alive through this, right? At least alive enough to explain what happened at the end, right? Are the stakes reduced in the fact that you know she makes it through this because she's explaining what happened? Now, the twist comes into that, which we'll talk about, but I found myself at the beginning of the movie saying, okay, well, I know she survives this because she's the one telling the story. So that's I don't know if that's a necessary thing. And apparently that wasn't in the original screenplay as well. Maybe that's a studio thing of they wanted her to be recounting the story. But I didn't necessarily think it worked for me until the end. And I was like, oh, now I know why they did that, because it makes a lot more sense. And it adds another layer of messing with you, messing with the audience, and making you think. Yeah. Then it's like, well, why? It almost feels like a waste of time, in a sense. But sure. But it's a good trick to play.
I thought it was effective. It reminded me a lot of Blade Runner, not just in like the narration of it, because that's basically what it is. But because I'd heard that too, Kent, that originally that wasn't part of the movie, and that they added that in afterwards, which is exactly what happened with Blade Runner. Was Ridley Scott made this cut and no one could understand what was happening, and so they added in the Harrison Ford voiceover and stuff. So I thought it was a little better than that, I guess, but it did not distract me from the what I was enjoying from the film, I'll say. And I think, as much as we might want to say, and we might be right in saying that the movie is better without those sequences, perhaps, I think that if you get rid of those shots and those scenes, those are kind of base points. It's like anchor points, I guess. Like, you're tied into those, and without them, I think there's a really good chance that the movie becomes very difficult to stick with and understand and comprehend what all is going on. I think those points really serve, as much as anything, serve to like reground the audience and let them kind of see, like maybe answer a couple of questions here and there. Like, you're right, Kyle, I don't think that the main point of this movie for Alex Garland is to answer questions about it, but I think without those sequences, you start to get to a place where it does become too confusing, too convoluted, or maybe I'm just, maybe I'm dumb, but it might have for me, I think, if I'm not able to, maybe that's a concession to an attempt to find something resembling a wider audience, which this, I don't think, was ever going to find, no matter what. But I didn't mind them, and I thought it probably helped my grasp of what was going on throughout the shimmer scenes.
So it would be a little derivative, like Arrival or something, to have the movie start with Natalie being this normal girl, this professor, John Hopkins, right? Teaching about cells, doing her whole thing, having a romantic scene with Oscar Isaac that they show them in bed together, and then, the government knocks on our door. We need your help with something,
Yeah.
And that whole thing happening, or your husband, something happened with your husband. That would have felt a little bit derivative. So they did go a different route, but again, it maybe would have helped me be in the shoes of the protagonist a little bit better if we didn't have that interrogation stuff going on. Maybe there would have been more mystery involved of, she doesn't know what she's getting herself into, and neither do we. and we're just on for the ride. I really liked that about Arrival, how it's all just like, I have no idea what's going on here. And the only thing you know is what Lawrence Fishburne is telling Amy Adams. So that really works for that film. But I love the environment, man. I think the thing that worked best for me was the plants that were in the shapes of humans, like walking together, you know, that eerie kind of ghost-like shape of the humans. I really liked that. The deer with the plants growing out of them was kind of cool. Felt a little Avatar-y in a way, in a not a very good way. But the stuff at the end is so good. I don't want to get spoilers now, but we need to hit spoilers here in about 2 minutes, or we're going to run out of time in order to fully break down the end. But I think it's the environment is great. But the creature design goes from good to really good at the end of the movie, if I could say that. Mm. But I was impressed overall. I love the way he shoots a film. I love his muted blacks. Like he pulls down the black and the color saturation a little bit, gives that little that muted quality, that matte finish, if you will, to the film. And I love Garland's sensibility, and I think he's got a lot of talent for writing, man. This is a guy that him and Danny Boyle together with 28 Days Later, I don't think enough people realize what a risk that movie was, you know, at the time and making that. And I'm surprised Annihilation even got made. Let's talk about that, because this is super obscure and it's Alex Garland, and I guess they were banking on the fact that everyone liked Ex Machina to kind of be the selling point and to get Natalie Portman involved, right? And Oscar Isaac coming off another Star Wars, and they had a little bit of star power there, but this isn't a typical big studio movie. How did this get made in obviously a good way?
Yeah, that's something that studios have got to figure out. And quite honestly, it's something that filmmakers have got to figure out too, is how we want movies like this to exist. We want them to get, I don't need this movie to get, 4,000 screens. That's not necessary. And it wouldn't have done particularly well on that number of screens, but it got 2,000, and that's an achievement. That's something, you know, but it also made $11 million. It's not really getting released overseas. Seems like it cost 40 to make it. I don't know. I want these movies to exist. We've got $40 million is probably around the right amount of money that you can spend on a movie like this and hope to not lose much. Like, I don't know, at $11 million on its opening weekend, I don't know that it's going to be profitable, but hopefully you're not going to just get crushed on it. And I don't know. Like, I get the idea that the money, I don't know. Every once in a while we get angry email or tweet or whatever complaining that we talked about how much money that a movie made, and that's not the point. The art is the point. But the point is, if movies like this come out and they don't make money, or worse, if they lose a lot of money, then they don't get made the next time around. And so I don't know how this got a wide release. Maybe what studio was this? Maybe they wanted to be in the this is Paramount, so maybe they want to be in the Alex Garland business, which is great. That's a great idea for us. I don't know that it's a great idea for like mass audiences. Does that make sense? Like, it's
that's what I mean. It's not a big studio to me. Yeah, this is like it seems Lionsgate would make this, or somebody like that, or right. A24, right. not Paramount. Yeah. I don't know.
This is where I feel like this is the place where, more than anywhere else, where we need to, the studios and the entire industry needs to adjust, to figure out what movies can get made, what, how many theaters we need to put them in, what the budget on these sorts of things is, blah, 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 blah. Like, this is the area where we really need to, like, there's the most room for, I don't know if growth is the right word, but kind of like a streamlining to figure it out. Because we want these movies to exist. If Annihilation next week, if it makes $4 million and it's sitting at 15 or 16 mil after 2 weeks and about to drop out of theaters, then, you know, then this movie doesn't get made next time around, this type of movie. And that's the problem, is finding the right, what's our budget for this kind of movie? How many screens are we going to put it in? What kind of advertising push are we going to put behind it and on down the list? Because eventually, I'm afraid what happens is all these types of movies, they either completely don't get made or they are all on Netflix. And then they're part of the Netflix brand, which we're going to talk about Mute later this week. And, you know, and so that's a concern. So it concerns me that Paramount really pulled the plug on this, especially overseas, and just said their audience, and basically said audiences are not smart enough to see this movie and to sit through it and enjoy it. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I do know that that's concerning for the next time around, that whoever, whether it's Alex Garland or you know, somebody like him, wants to make this kind of like highbrow science fiction. It's not great. That's a very long-winded way to say I'm not enthused about how what this looks like when it comes out and it makes 11 mil, which doesn't, again, is like, I did not expect it to make very much money. I wonder what the studio felt about it when they greenlit this movie to begin with.
Yeah. You wonder if the strategy should be let these movies come out in semi limited release, maybe film festival, something like that, build some positive word, maybe build a little bit more of a buzz, and then put it out. I think 11 million is a win for them at the end of the day. I think you can still sell this thing and to Netflix and make your money.
I hope so. It's a $40 million movie. I hope they see it that way. That's the thing. I hope Paramount sees that this way. I hope that when they greenlit this movie, they said to themselves, hey, if this movie makes $12 million its opening weekend, we'll be thrilled with that. You know, I don't know. I don't know what those kind of conversations are like.
Exactly. So spoilers time, spoilers now. So it's time for spoilers. If you haven't seen Annihilation, go see it and come back and join us for spoilers. So, something that I found a little bit obvious was in terms of the direction was how he kept going back to the glasses of water, right? The reflection through the glasses of water between the people and the hands and all that. The connections with the cells and duplicating cells. I didn't find most of that stuff, the metaphor for what was going to happen or the foreshadowing for what was going to happen, to be that hidden in the movie. I guess it was, I don't know if that's a good thing that I understood that immediately, or if it should have been more gracefully done. That's beside the point. But the entire thing is, so her husband, Natalie Portman's husband, Oscar Isaac, that we come to know in the first of the movie, something could be up with him, right? He was different. He was sick when she got back. She didn't know why everything was like that. Well, she ends up finding out why when she comes across the video camera in the shimmer inside of the lighthouse. And for me, this is where the movie, I was like super into it at this point. I mean, I think the dialogue completely stops up until then, unless it's what we're hearing on the video camera, right? The score takes over, which is fantastic. And we really just get some of the best physical choreography acting that I've seen in a long time. It almost felt like Fantasia or something. You're just watching something poetic and magical take place on the screen. And for the last 20 minutes, I felt that. I was completely mesmerized by the last sequence, the reveal of the double, the reveal of the her going down into the hole and the blood going into the whatever it's called, the little orb thing, you know, and that whole, all the visuals there. It felt like, you know, the ending of The Fountain or something crazy. It's just like, what is going on? It's just totally trippy. And then we get the alien in the sequence with her and the double. I thought the creature design on the doppelganger alien was stunning. I was blown away by that. Just got chills when I saw it. You know, it was just so everything I wanted it to be and what an alien creature should be or look like, in my opinion, you know? And the way it moved, the way it mimicked her movement, the way she became a victim of her own self, essentially, you know, all the metaphor there. is the self-destruction aspect of this movie that they hammer home a lot. The theme of self-destruction and how it's inevitable, and humans essentially brought it into this world, you know, into that world of the Shimmer. But man, that last sequence, I can't say enough good things about that. And, you know, I said I was bored through the movie, but I alluded to earlier, the last 5 minutes really can make or break a movie. And in my opinion, the ending made this movie. And I was just so happy with how it ended. I wish it could have ended a little more ambiguous. We'll talk about that. But in terms of that whole sequence, the doppelganger fight and what did you guys think? Were you rolling your eyes, or were you like me and were just like, wow, these are what this, it reminded me. I mean, it was like Kubrick or something, you know, it reminded me of the final sequence of 2001, where it's just, the visuals and audio are just taking over at that point. And that's cinematic. That's movie. So what did you guys think, Brian?
Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was really well done, and it worked very well. And was a little bit terrifying, but also kind of awestruck at the same time, which is great. Richard, what'd you think on that?
Yeah, no, it was fine. I mean, the design was great, but as a plot, it wasn't super interesting to me. But I mean, it logically made sense, like you were talking about the beginning with everything. Mm. It did do the Jurassic Park trick where they at least respected our intelligence enough to explain things just enough. So I loved all that, but it didn't really floor me in terms of the philosophy or anything behind it. Kyle, what about you? What'd you think?
I was totally blown away by that sequence. And I'm not normally good at this in movies, but I was able to see at least one interpretation for me was how that scene can be interpreted as someone's battle with mental illness or depression, which all of those women were kind of suffering from some form of. That was what they made a point of in that kind of exposition-y scene when they were paddling, to kind of establish that. But the idea that any kind of mental illness, you can kind of see it in yourself and the battle against yourself. And then when the duplicate has Natalie Portman's character pressed up against the wall, there's that kind of suffocating feeling that people talk about.
The way that was shot was so good. The way he pressed the close-up of the camera to her face when she's being pressed against that wall, it was just like, wow, the claustrophobia there. I love that.
And there's another kind of theory that I've seen float around, like about the personas we create, like online and in public, how those can kind of, there's like a lot of interesting allegorical things you can pull from this that are certainly worth discussing and reading about and everything. It's a very thought-provoking, ambitious film in that regard, for sure.
Yeah. No, Dust, I was just going to say, but I thought it was interesting, no matter kind of how you read it, the end result was pretty much killing whatever it is, and that can be very morbid if you think of it in a human sense, but just your sense of survival of what you think the best thing to do is annihilation, bringing it back to the movie itself. So I just thought that was so well done. Like you're saying, that last 20, 25 minutes with the limited to no dialogue was sensational.
It was, man. Still thinking about it. Makes me want to see the movie again, just so I can just go back and watch that. But the real reason I want to go back and watch it again is there's a twist at the end, of course, right? So what essentially happens is she's fighting with her own doppelganger, right? One that's at first completely alien, but over the course of the sequence turns more and more into Lena, or Natalie Portman's character, and essentially becoming her new version of herself, or her clone, or her mirrored version, right? So Natalie Portman learns of this when she watches the tape and learns that, oh my God, that wasn't my husband. That was actually maybe his double. And this sad reality creeps in. And so then the audience is thinking, when are they going to switch roles, right? How many times have we seen this done? And then just the past year, 2 or 3 times, right? The Alien Covenant, right? Life, right? Mm-hmm. At the end.
Yeah.
The old switcheroo, right? I thought it was coming. I didn't know if it would or not. I thought the execution of it was sly. there's still a question. Essentially, they both make it out of the shimmer of the husband and wife, Natalie and Oscar. But the only reason they do is because people think that it's their doppelganger versions, right? That their real versions were left behind or destructed. And these doppelganger versions are now living on and essentially will create the new shimmer if, in fact, that that happens. So did you guys see that coming? To me, I saw it coming, but I didn't essentially see it coming the way it did. Oh, and there's some people that think that they never switched at all, you know, that there's that was her the real Natalie Portman and not her doppelganger, which I don't buy into. I thought it was pretty obvious that they switched or they switch roles. And in Alex Garland's original screenplay, he has a direct line in the screenplay that says, I'm going to read the line so that I don't, but I don't butcher it. It says, quote, "There is no clear indication as to which Lena lived and which Lena died," unquote. So I think the studio went back in there. It's like, we need to put a little something maybe that hints that it's the Lena that we think it is and not, not completely ambiguous. I wish it would have been left more in the open, but I love that trick. That's that trope. And if it's done correctly, I think it's very effective. I kind of saw it coming, but I still thought it was effective at the end of the day that, there was some kind of switcheroo there that we didn't quite catch. So I'm excited to go back and rewind and find where the switcheroo was. I think it was somewhere when they were laying down and they got passed out between the bomb and all that. So, what do you guys think? What did you think of the ending or the twist, if you want to call it that?
I thought it was fine. I mean, it was fine for me, but just a little bit by the book in terms of what you expect for a sci-fi movie. And this was kind of an out there experience in terms of a sci-fi movie. So I was kind of expecting a little more. So it just left me a little bit cold, but it's obviously very well executed. I just didn't find it to be particularly original. It seemed like kind of just walking out of the, putting us in this world and then we emerge from it. I don't know. To me, it was just a little bit in the box, but a very effective use of said box. Kyle, what about you?
Well, like we were talking about earlier with how they set the movie up with Natalie Portman's interrogation scene, that sets you up with that it might not be a reliable narrator who's telling the story.
It's completely fake. That's what it means. It's like it's might piss the audience off a little bit, to be honest, to learn that at the end. It's like, well, so all that was just to mislead us, essentially, to make the twist work better. And I think as that device, it works really well. And it does. I didn't see that at all, that was the double the whole time in the interrogation room. Brian, what were you going to say?
Yeah, no, I thought it was pretty predictable. I don't know. Again, it may be the book have given me a little inside knowledge, but I felt like it was pretty obvious that at least Oscar Isaac and probably Natalie Portman were not who they said they were from the outset. But I think I'm kind of on Richard's side. It was pretty predictable. It wasn't very original, but it was very effective in its usage of that idea. And that I don't know what necessarily to call it a trope, but that the concept was they did a very good. He did a very good job with it once that was the decision to move forward. But I wasn't. I can't say that I was surprised or shocked by the twist. That seemed like that shot had been called fairly early on in the movie to me.
I think it's less about the fact that she doesn't get out, and more about the fact that the human race doesn't know that their doppelgangers got out. Right, that they're essentially going to start this entire new whatever's to come, right? That they think it's over, but in fact, right, it's only just begun. I love that. Mm-hmm. The indication of more to come, especially mm-hmm. with a movie mm-hmm. like Life last year, where it's like, wow, we really only started with this thing. I like the endings like that, that more look to future events rather than resolve the events previously. So, man, lots to talk about here, lots of themes here with self-destruction and the army itself, and to talk about the political leanings of the movie and what it says about all that, and the fact that it's set in the American South and it's an all-female cast who are each struggling with individual issues of their own, and there's a lot that he put in here. So it is one of those movies that's meant to stimulate its audience and to cause conversation, and for that reason, I think it perfectly accomplishes its goal. But any closing thoughts, things I didn't hit here? We do have to hit a weekly recommend here, so don't want to go too much further, but yeah.
No, that's all I got. I think it looked great. The creature design was really cool. I can't remember. I think it was you, Kent, that said you kind of would have liked to spend more time kind of with the world building, and I agree with that. I wish they would have shown a little more. I don't know that I would have wanted more time figuring it out. Does that make sense? Like, the
right.
creature stuff is great. Like, that bear scene was terrifying and was so well done from just a straight horror movie standpoint.
I feel like there's more stuff that could go weird in there, right? Like, okay, you enter the you enter the setting, it's like, oh wow, the plants are crazy. And so that was like their main right. thing that this thing's offering the entire time. Yeah, but look how crazy the plant life is. I feel like there's more like, what if their eyeballs fell out of their sockets or something, you know, something crazy happens to these people in there other than just there's a crazy bear or oh my gosh, look at that deer. Like a total The laws of physics don't apply in there is what I was more looking for. The laws of nature, the laws of what we know as reality doesn't apply there. Rather than just, wow, this is weird. It's like we're in Alice in Wonderland all of a sudden. Yeah, sure. Maybe that's what they're wanting to explore with these sequels that didn't come out, right. You know?
I think if you go too far down that path, it becomes Avatar. It becomes like Pandora on Avatar. And I don't know that that's necessarily really like the point of the movie. So I would have liked to have seen more, but I thought it was at the same time that may have distracted from what was really going on throughout. But that's just me.
But Unobtainium?
No Unobtainium. So that's a plus.
All right. Anybody have anything else? Guest, Richard, nothing.
Nope. I'm good. No,
I think I'm good.
All right. Let's hit grades. Bri.
It's going to be an A- for me. A-. Really good. I don't know that it's the masterpiece that some people are claiming it to be, but who knows? It does seem like a movie that 5 years down the line, after you've seen it a couple more times and have maybe a little more time for it to kind of sit with you, that it might be thought of a little higher for me at least, but for the moment, I thought it was a really good movie that wasn't quite great, except in its ridiculous visuals, which were spot on across the board. So A- for me. Richard, how about you?
Yeah, I'm gonna go just slightly below and go B+ for me. Not quite an A for me, but a strong movie. I would recommend it to people that have an interest in sci-fi, but not quite an A for me. A little bit of a miss on a few things. Kyle, what about you, my friend?
For me, it's an A+. I absolutely loved it. It was everything that I wanted, like I said before. And when you get a guy like Alex Garland, who, despite what seems like some studio pressure, still got to make the movie that he wanted, and you could see all of his DNA, no pun intended with the movie, but kind of all over the place and doing exactly what he wants to do. So that's going to be an A+ for me.
Yeah, I think it's not quite the masterpiece level of Ex Machina, in my opinion. I think it has some strong rewatchability. I think it has a timeless nature to it that it is going to lend itself to going back and maybe putting this in the context of his filmography, Alex Garland's filmography. To me, it's an A-. A few things that I did mention earlier that I wanted to see more of that could have been fleshed out a little bit better. Didn't quite have the snap and the pacing of Ex Machina in terms of how well that movie flowed. So I noticed some things there. So that's where it gets a few points off for me. But that ending is going to make me coming back, and the visuals and everything exceeded my expectation. On that level. So that's why it stays an A, and that's why I'm going to revisit it multiple times in the future and figure out what the heck's going on with that ending and pinpoint where things went awry. So excited about that. And man, This is what I like, man. We talked Cloverfield for like an hour a couple weeks ago, right? I just like the conversation that it lends to. I love the theories. I love all the speculation. If you have your own thoughts on Annihilation and what the ending means, what the beginning means, what all of it means, please feel free to reach out at Mad About Movies on Twitter or shoot us an email. We would love to carry on the conversation. But let's move on and hit a recommend, guys.
Weekly recommends.
How about Richard Barton?
I've got a new show on Netflix. I love food. And there's a new show on Netflix David Chang does with a few other people called Ugly Delicious. And it's a great food show and a little bit of a travel show, but mostly food. It's a really unique, kind of with an edge style show. So I'm cheating on my beloved Bay, Guy Fieri, Fieri, and watching Ugly Delicious and really, really loving it. I think it's one of the best shows Netflix has had in quite some time.
I saw the thumbnail to it, and it was just like crap on a plate. That's what's called Ugly Delicious. Like, it looks bad, but it tastes good. Is that the pitch there?
No, it's just, I don't really know. I think it's more their attitude is ugly. They're like ugly Americans, but the food is all beautiful and stunning. The first episode's all about pizza. Second episode's all about tacos. Two things that I wholeheartedly endorse. I'm actually vegetarian right now for Lent, so it was kind of torturous to watch, but definitely salivatingly good.
Wow, salivatingly good. Put that on the poster.
Absolutely. Well, that's how I put it. I just have posters that say just that with no context.
Yeah. Okay, that's a good one. What about you, Brian?
I'm going to recommend a TV show that I've been a huge fan of from the outset, but I have been, it's been my binge of choice, like my background show when I'm winding down at the end of the night or writing or whatever. Over the last few weeks, Brooklyn Nine-Nine is on Hulu, so I've been watching all that. I'm in the middle of season 3 right now. I believe there are 5 seasons, and it is kind of on the bubble for renewal this coming fall, I guess. So who knows? This may be the end of it. But it's hilarious. It's incredibly well written. It's a Mike Schur show, so that's Parks and Rec and The Good Place, and he understands my particular taste in comedy, I think, as well, if not better than anybody. And it's also in syndication now too, which is cool. So maybe there's a chance that I'm hoping that will help it get picked up for a 6th season. Character development is great. All the actors and actresses are really funny, and they do just really absurd stuff. And it's kind of feels like the role that Andy Samberg was made to play. It's perfect. But Andre Brower is otherworldly. It's kind of it's like a Ron Swanson to Leslie Knope situation. It's he's so good, and it's a really, really funny show that I think I had underrated how quickly it finds its groove and gets really funny. Like, it's from maybe episode 5 or 6 in the first season on, which is really hard to do for a network TV sitcom to find its groove that quickly. And it does. And it never valleys after that peak. It's mm-hmm. really, really funny throughout from there on. And so check it out. If you have not done so before, it's all on Hulu, and it's taken the place of like one or two Big Bang Theories a day on TBS. So throw that in.
God, it's like, praise the Lord.
Getting there.
So yeah, we're on the path, guys.
You're going to have to go refer to your Big Bang Theory anthology DVD collection when they
yeah, exactly.
Gosh, I mean, exactly. What a time, so, man. What a
so time. No, it's only on now Big Bang Theory is only on TBS like 12 times a day instead of 13 or 14, but we're making progress. We're slowly getting there. But it's great. You guys should, if you guys haven't seen it, please check it out or get caught up with it. But the listeners, especially, get out there and check out Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of episodes. I'm not necessarily in order or anything like that. Really enjoy it. It's a fun one. Yeah, have it on the background. It's a good. Yeah. Watch it while you're having your morning coffee before work, kind of a show, and love it, and hope it gets renewed. I didn't know it was on the bubble. I thought it was obviously working, and they were just going to keep it for the foreseeable future. I didn't know it was.
Yeah,
I thought everybody liked it.
It's never done great ratings wise, but neither did anything? The Office or Parks or anything really, because the ratings are terrible and stupid and suck. But Mike Schur, you know, he has good plays. So he's not really super involved with Brooklyn Nine-Nine at all anymore. And I think he just got another pilot picked up for the fall. So.
He has that Shea Serrano one too.
Yeah. So he's like turning into the showrunner du jour. I mean, it's like it seems like his name is being thrown out there constantly, which is hilarious to think about that Mose from The Office is like the most powerful man in TV.
He has the rights to Infinite Jest too.
Oh, sweet.
He's had those since college, and Regis is his father-in-law. So he's got it all going for him.
Amazing. So just definitely check that out. Kyle, what's your weekly recommend, man?
My weekly recommend is a documentary that came out last year called The Work. It takes place in Folsom State Prison in California. And the premise is essentially there is a group of civilians who volunteer to attend a week-long group therapy session with the prisoners. And it's one of the more human and raw things you'll see as people try to relate to people they didn't think they could on both sides. And it was something that I didn't have a lot of expectations for going in. It was kind of a random thing I saw on Amazon and gave it a watch. And it's a really affecting kind of human masterpiece, I thought.
Awesome. I am going to recommend a documentary as well. This is one I'd seen a couple years ago. I revisited it this past week and really enjoyed it. Hitchcock Truffaut. It is essentially a conversation between François Truffaut and the great Alfred Hitchcock. Basically, François Truffaut was obsessed with Alfred Hitchcock growing up and as he was making movies. And back in his time, he was writing letters to Alfred Hitchcock saying, "I love your work. I'm a French filmmaker. You know, I want to come talk to you." And Hitchcock, you know, they started up this pen pal relationship and they ended up meeting and having great conversations together, which were recorded in a lot of instances. And it's just about the art of making movies. And there's a book that it's based on, of course, but just some of the best advice, just how movies are made, what audiences look for, how to really make suspense work, how to make endings work, things like that. They're just kind of riffing off each other and sharing advice on what they like about movies. And it's really a fun time, educational time, and a good look at those two guys. So Hitchcock Truffaut is a good documentary and a book, companion book, if you want to read that, François Truffaut's book, Hitchcock Truffaut. But there is a documentary that kind of covers that total stuff if you would rather do that than read. But both get my recommend. And yeah, great documentary. It won Best Documentary at the Denver Film Festival, by the way. Fun fact. Hitchcock Truffaut. Check it out. Okay. This has been a fun conversation. And maybe the last Alex Garland conversation we'll have for a while. But hopefully not the last. Thank you so much for coming on. Brian, where can we find you on the internet?
You can find me on the Twitter at BGill12. You can find my writing at madaboutmoviespodcast.com and the Mad About Movies podcast newsletter. Richard, I can't get in touch with you on the internet as I had hoped. Where might I find you?
Well, I'm only on Tor browsers now because of the content of my social media. No, you can find me on all social media at Richard Barden. Hit me up any of those places. And you can find me on the Bottom Up Movies podcast newsletter, which we have some stuff coming post Oscars next week. And we've got a VIP newsletter full of links and briefings and goodness that we do for you VIPs out there of the world. So that's a reason to sign up in and of itself. Kyle, man, I sense a bond between us. I want to grow that bond even further. So where can I find you online?
I'm on all of the social medias at Kyle McNevin. So you can hit me up there for my thoughts.
Thanks for coming on, man. You were great as per usual. You're two for two, batting 1,000. So Hopefully you got to go back to something terrible though. We're going to alternate, you know, you did Power Rangers and then this. So next time I want your choice to be something truly, truly horrific. Okay. Like Power Rangers.
Yeah. I'm just waiting on the Power Rangers sequel. I'm booked for that.
Okay. Good, good, good. Cool. You hear that? He's throwing down the gauntlet. Kent, Perfect. Where can I find you online?
Find me at Kent Garrison on Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, and at KentGarrison.com. Hit subscribe on iTunes. If you like what you hear, you want to hear more episodes, maybe some throwback conversations on some older movies, maybe us talking about our favorite flavors of Tootsie Pops, you know, those types of things. Mm. Hilarious, fun
that
banter.
That was the best 3 hours we ever did.
It was, and it's only available on the Mad About Movies VIP. Check that out, madaboutmoviespodcast.com/VIP. Support yourself, support the show, and everybody wins. Next week, we will return here to discuss Game Night, I believe. Yeah, something like that. And in the VIP this week, we're talking about Mute, I believe, and In Bruges coming up. So lots of fun times ahead. So thank you for joining us, and we will see you
Belgium.
Next time. Just letting you know. In Bruges, in Belgium. Bye.
Play.
Hey, baby, I hear the blues are calling. Tossed salads and scrambled eggs. And maybe I seem a bit confused. Yeah, maybe, but I got you pegged. But I don't know what to do with those tossed salads and scrambled eggs. They're calling again. Scrambled eggs all over my face.
They're making me yah-yah.